December of last year, the council set up a Finance and Public Administration Committee, pretty much on the lines of the one in the Senate here. Now, it has conducted but one inquiry, and it's a bit hard to tell how well it's going to work because it was an inquiry into an issue in which the two big parties were basically at one, so there wasn't any heat in it, so it's a bit hard to tell. But if there's any grounds for optimism, it's in there. And as I said, we haven't got enough evidence yet to judge that. Okay, themes. All right, there's been a high degree of partisanship evident everywhere. The select committees are characterised by multiple vote divisions, which always come out 3-2. A bit like the American Supreme Court in a similar way. There are minority reports all the time. There are government members, not necessarily cabinet ministers, but government members in the upper house as well, have denounced the select committees as witch hunts. The government has refused leave to assembly ministers to appear before upper house committees and extended it, as will become come as no great surprise to you, to ministerial advisers. Also, the executive has asserted a very broad scope of executive privilege, or as it's, I think this is a somewhat sanitised description of it as public interest immunity. I think executive privilege is probably worth retaining. And it's issued very restrictive instructions as to what questions public servants may answer. There have been innumerable invocations of commercial in confidence explanations for not providing material, all of them untested, because there is no situation as there is in New South Wales. There's no, if you like, halfway house. There's no way in which privileged documents can be seen by members of the committee but not published. It's either one or nothing, and it's invariably, well, it's not nothing. I mean, the departments and government have given the committees loads of documents, except that they haven't given them all the documents. This is not a new phenomenon. I've just started reading David Day's recently published biography of Andrew Fisher. When the Labor Party accidentally formed a government in Queensland in 1899, which lasted precisely 1 week, at least gave them access to departmental papers. And there was brewing scandal going on at the time that the previous government was going to grant what we'd now call part of a national park to a private railway company. Now, Fisher was the Minister for Railways, so he got into the papers. The government only lasted a week. And then Fisher asked questions in the Parliament of the new government, which was the old government slightly reconstructed, and asked for documents. Documents were produced, and Fisher said to the Minister, "Are these the complete documents?" And the Minister said, "Yes, they're the complete documents," whereupon Fisher reached for the sheaf of additional documents, and I think the Minister was sacked and scandal ensued. So there's nothing new about any of this. The opposition is not pure on this either. They have been provocative and accusatory before committees have even taken a word of evidence. They have assumed at least misfeasance, if not malfeasance, and made a big thing about it, which of course just injects partisanship in it. For those of you who are interested, the first interim report of the Committee on Gaming Licences, which you can access on the Legislative Council's webpage, has a very interesting appendix of letters and legal opinions on the issue of attendance by ministers, attendance by public servants, attendance by ministerial advisers, presentation of documents and so on. Now, one of the people invited to attend that committee was the then recently retired Premier, Mr. Brax, who signed a letter. It doesn't bear his writing style. Presumably it was written elsewhere. It's worth briefly quoting part of it. He said, "The Select Committee is inquiring into matters relating to my time as Premier and member of the Legislative Assembly. I was and remain accountable and responsible to that House of Parliament alone for the performance of my functions as Premier. The Select Committee cannot claim, much less exercise, any authority over a member of the other House. This immunity must continue after a person has ceased being a member. Otherwise, the purpose of the immunity, and this was a new one on me, the purpose of the immunity was, quote, to preserve the independence of the Houses, and this would be defeated. One of the ploys that the executive is using is not so much saying that ministers will not appear, it is saying that members of the Legislative Assembly will not appear, and those who are ministers and members of the Legislative Assembly will not appear. Not to be outdone, a firm of solicitors wrote a letter to the committee saying that their clients wouldn't attend because the Legislative Council Committee didn't have the power to subpoena strangers before it. Strangers in that parliamentary term. That didn't work. Okay, quickly to end, what are the consequences of this? Okay, there's no evidence of any culture of scrutiny emerging, even amongst the opposition. There's a little bit of it there amongst the Greens and the DLP candidate, a little bit. If there's any, that's where it is. The opposition behaves the opposition. The government members on the committee are there to defend the government, not to inquire into much. The relations between the executive and its supporters and the Legislative Council are toxic. Being in the parliament sometimes is like walking on eggshells. The relationship is so bad. The opposition, when they were debating the Parliamentary Appropriation Bill last year, threatened that if things don't change, they were going to start amending the allocation of monies under the Parliamentary Appropriation Bill. We haven't had yet any threat to impede legislation, even though that power has been reduced. There is something there. I mean, I think it's the standard thing. Big parties don't do this on the principle of there, but for the grace of God go we, and we establish precedents that we won't want used against us. Conclusion, I will quote Dr. Russell, who sits before us, that parties in government, even when consisting of, quote, true Democrats, resist close scrutiny of their actions. I don't think there's any partisanship in it. It's government. Any optimism to end? Okay, maybe we have been just too optimistic. There's 150 years of bad relations between the government in the lower house and the Legislative Council in Victoria, and on that matter, the Legislative Council doesn't have a clean slate of virtue. So I think it's going to take, if it does happen, it's going to take some time to get away from that relationship, which was, historically, very antagonistic to some other culture. So I'm less optimistic this time than I was 5 years ago. Come
back in 5 years. OK, despite my inadvertence in getting us away slightly late, we've got 12, 15 minutes, something like that, for questions. Are there any? John.
John, you're ANU. Bruce, this is to you, and it's really to invite you to compare Australia and Canada, because we've got two contrasting archives of history, where Canada's gone in one direction, rolling back not just the powers of upper houses, but the existence of upper houses. Mm-hmm. And you've told a very different story about a kind of modernisation, democratisation program, which presumably has interesting international lessons, but it's so different to another Westminster-derived system. Could you just focus on the Australia-Canada comparison?
Wow. I think you've probably caught me out on this. I can't really... My knowledge of Canadian history is not marvellous. You're right. There is a very different history there. I don't know. We've got some Canadians around the place who'd like to make a comment. Or ersatz Canadians. Campbell, would you like to say something?
Well, that's basically half my talk for tomorrow. But the simple answer is they were never elective. Canada has no tradition of strong bicameralism, let alone strong elective bicameralism. And because Canada had responsible government very early on, self-government, they were still working out the mechanism of how to deal with any kind of parliamentary government, let alone one with an upper house. So...
If you're elective, an elective upper house is more likely to be abolished, but of course it doesn't always happen. Canada has one at the national level.
But it's not elected.
That's what I'm saying. It's no, you know, you're saying they weren't elected. Well, you know, that makes them easier to knock off, I agree.
Yeah,
one out of two in Australia went that way.
Easy to knock off if you come to my lecture tomorrow.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, that's whetted our appetite.
Actually, while I'm here, I have a question. Or really, it's an observation about both the New South Wales Upper House and Victoria, and that is that we shouldn't underestimate the time it takes for parliaments and parties and voters to adjust to changes to the rules. I mean, you could say it took the Senate at least 20 years, and depending on how you do your sums, longer, to come to terms with the changed landscape. And so that's, and say New South Wales is a good example. It took a long time for New South Welsh persons to realise that they actually had a choice and they could split their vote and whatever. I suppose the last point and related one is that we've got to assume that the voters, we have to, this is a big assumption always, but we assume that the voters have some say eventually about this. And that you shouldn't underestimate the ability of the voters to get sick of some particular arrangement. And so what you do with an institutional arrangement is create the potential for things to happen. They may not happen. They may never happen. On the other hand, the range of possible things that can happen is often much wider than the designers of the institutions ever considered.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's very, very true. And in the 22 years I've worked for Parliament, I've seen so many unintended consequences of you know, great designs. But I think one of the biggest problems with the change to the way that we're... I mean, I think there had to be a change. What happened in 1999 was an abomination of a democratic process. I mean, if I can be so bold. If something hadn't been done, I think it would have given grounds to get rid of the upper house. It just destroyed our credibility. On the other hand, it was a very exciting time for the working as a clerk, I can tell you that. Never a dull moment. But I think one of the biggest problems with the changes is I don't know that people are really aware of the fact that they don't have preferences now unless they put them on. That hasn't seemed to have been put out to the electorate that it's... I mean, it is optional, but if you don't do it, then you don't have it, whereas they're used to the fact that you only had to put a one on there and you had...
Get the whole thing.
You got your preferences distributed. And I think that... Oh, do people not understand that? Oh, that's why I don't want to hear Clark. It's taking me so long. I mean, I've got a copy of a ballot paper here that shows you that we have... This is just a very simple rendition of it, but we have, like, above the line and below the line voting. You have the choice of voting above the line or below the line. And if you vote above the line, you're just voting for the block of the people underneath. And you only get a box above the line if you have 15 candidates underneath. So you can imagine when we had 264 candidates, how big the paper got, because you had to have the blocks above as well as the lines underneath with all the different names. But what's happening now is every party's got to put... If you want to get one of these little boxes up the top, you've got to have 15 people prepared to stand. So, of course, that's very off-putting to minor parties who may not have 15 people who are willing to put their name onto a paper. In the past, if you put a one under the first group here is the No Fun Party. So if you put the... Because this is just a sample. I wonder. If you put a one in this box, then... And this party didn't get elected. Before 1999, this party would have had a preference flow that they would have lodged before the election with the electoral commissioner. Now, admittedly, people argued that was not democratic because you didn't know that, unless you went out of your way to find out.
A preference flow across all of the candidates listed below that line.
Well, when you voted...
As in the Senate.
Yeah, when you voted one here, it went all the way down, but you could have a one here and then only, like, three or four names under here. You didn't have to have 15 to get your box above the line. Plus, if those three didn't get elected, and many of the parties didn't, then their ticket would say, OK, if it doesn't go to the No Fun Party, it then goes to the Purple Party. Whereas now, if it doesn't go to the No Fun Party, if that gets exhausted, your vote just drops off and it doesn't count anymore. And I don't think people are aware of that. So what you have to do is go in there and not only put a 1 above, but you've got to put a 2 and a 3 and a 4 and a 5 and a 6 if you want to have your vote to continue to count. It's not such a big deal for the major parties, hence they're all in favour of it, because people often go and put a 1 against Labor or a 1 against Liberal, and they've got, you know, more than 15 candidates, because it's 15 we're electing for our House. But the reason the Greens supported it, and I can see why they did, is because they were the ones who suffered the most by this proliferation of parties with names that suggested people were looking after the environment. So that's why they supported it. But I think the outcome of it is that a lot of people's votes aren't being counted anymore because they're voting for parties, because they're no longer as fond of the major parties as they once were. So they're voting for minor parties, and then when those people don't get a quota, their vote's just disappearing. And that doesn't seem all that democratic either. So I'm not quite sure what the answer should be to that.
Brian, did you have a response to Campbell? That's basically your argument, I thought, that a potential had been created. It may not be... Did you have any further comment?
No, I'll let Richard.
Yeah, OK.
Richard,
sure.
This is the Richard Hurra, Tasmania, the pots and kettles and calling each other black, but our three states have treasurers in the upper house. Mm-hmm. I think it's iniquitous. I think it's wrong in all sorts of ways. Yes, I know. And, of course, New South Wales started it. And if Michael Egan's claim in 1995 is correct, it's the first time it had happened since 1688 in any Westminster Parliament. My question really is it in your two states because the government wants to hide the most important ministry away from the scrutiny of the lower house and to prevent the treasurer from being subject to the kind of intensive forensic examination that would occur, given what you've said about the inability of upper houses, in fact, to fully use the weaponry of question time and debate to get the kind of answers that they need out of the Treasurer.
Who wants to go first?
Yes, I think it's very silly of a party to put a treasurer into a house that they don't control. Now, why did it happen in Victoria? It's the Labor Party factions. You know, prizes had to be given. People were in line. You know, it was a senior position. That person was in line for the senior position, promoted by his faction. That's what happened. Didn't give a thought to it, it seems to me. But the interesting thing about it is that Mr. Lenders in Victoria suffered the fate of Mr. Egan. He got suspended from the Legislative Council for not producing documents. I forgot one of the interesting things is that the Legislative Council Committee on Gaming sought a legal opinion as to whether or not it had the right to call documents. And guess what? The legal opinion said yes. Now, to give them praise, they published the opinion. When the government was confronted with this, they said, but we've got another legal opinion that says that you don't have power to subpoena documents, to which members of the committee said, may we see it, please? They said, I don't know, that's under professional privilege. Wow. And also that the argument behind it all was that the New South Wales Legislative Council can demand documents, but the Victorian one can't because the constitutions are so different that Victoria doesn't have the power. Yeah. Now, I am very keen to see that legal opinion because it's a new one on me.
I know a little bit about that one. It's a slightly different issue, but the reason that the Treasurer comes from the upper house is, as Brian says, Michael Egan was a very senior figure in the Labor Party and he was in the upper house. He had been in the lower house previously. He said he was going to stay in the upper house till he abolished it, but, you know, we wore him out in the long run. But he wanted the Treasury, and that's why he got it. I wasn't so keen on his successor. I would have been happy to give Treasury back to the lower house. But it'll be interesting to see how Roosendaal handles it. We start the estimates process next Monday. So I actually don't think it matters which house the Treasurer is in at the moment, because until we get a really effective opposition, I don't think that anyone's going to really hold them to much account, but I don't think it's an attempt to actually hide. I think it's got a lot more to do with the actual spoils of government, who gets what, and it just happens to be which house they were in. Because trust me, if Joe Tripodi could have got the Treasury, he would have. Yeah. And he just couldn't get it. It was unpalatable. But as far as the power of the upper house in Victoria goes, and I love this one because New South Wales does not have a Privileges Act. And it's been used against us time and time again, and we've had to go and prove our privileges. It's all got to be tested in the courts because we have no bit of legislation that says what our powers are. I mean, there are people who support that position just because once you codify something, you actually can limit your powers. And that's precisely what the argument has been in Victoria. It's got to do with the fact that there's a Privileges Act there, and that Privileges Act doesn't specify that the Parliament has the right to call papers or that the Legislative Council has. Consequently, therefore, it doesn't have that power. So we have a common law power to do it as an inherent right of a House of Parliament to call papers because we don't have a Privileges Act. But the government's arguing that they, because there's no privileges, because there is a privileges legislation in Victoria and it doesn't spell out that they can call papers, it doesn't have that power.
Okay, as Stan said earlier on, we've got a choice at this point. We've reached 3 o'clock, so we can go and have some more tea and bickies, or if anybody wants to ask a final question, hopefully one that, if you're asking me, that I can answer this time. Mike, would you like to?
I think the relationship in the committees of the Upper House of Western Australia is a lot more decorous than in Victoria. WA took on PR like a duck to water. Victoria obviously is having some sort of problems. I'm just wondering why. Am I right about this? Yes. I'm just wondering, can people maybe, Senator Pratt, try and get why this relationship in WA is, well, decorous and decent and proceeds, and why it is in Victoria so bad?
Well, quite a...
Ken Cokill, who isn't here, which is a good thing to do, he points out that when we had WA Inc. and the South Australian Bank and Pyramid and blah, 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 we were going through that period, even then the Legislative Council in Western Australia's committees were much more involved in probing those sorts of issues, where in Victoria, even though the Kerner government, the Kane government, did not have a majority in the upper house did nothing. Mm. Not a thing. So it had nothing to do with PR because it wasn't PR. They just are quiescent. And I think that's the point, one of the points that Campbell's made. I mean, when you look at what the committees are doing, they are unfamiliar with a lot of things. Some of it's quite ham-fisted as to how they're going about it because they haven't done it other than through the joint committees. Mm. So there's no experience of it.
Yeah, the quality of the members. Mm. Can I just make one final
point? Sure, of course.
I think, like the Senate, but probably to some extent even more cooperative than the Senate because there's actually much less media scrutiny in terms of you immediately going into a partisan response to the issues that you're actually dealing with.
I think one of the things that, like having watched what's gone on in our house, and our house has been incredibly active and it has started a lot of things, and I've written a paper on why treasurers can come from the upper house, Richard. But the quality of the membership has changed incredibly. Now, that's not... I don't want to be political about it, but we do have a changing clientele that we work with. And there's a number of reasons for that, I'm sure. But what's being called the professionalism of members of Parliament is to some extent it's a shrinking sort of base of members of parliament, the type of members that you're getting. They're predominantly career politicians. They do their university studies. They go and work for a backbencher. Then they go and work for a minister, and then they become a member. And that is the career path. Now, I think there's room for that. I do think there's room for having these professional, you know, people who come through the system. But in the past, we had a whole range of people. And the Egan cases would never have happened if we hadn't had a Hannaford in our house, who was the leader of the opposition at the time, who was willing to take it on, who had the intellect to deal with that, who had the experience, who'd been outside and done other things. One of the reasons was put to me recently by a member of parliament is that the 1999 changes, not just to our electoral law, but to the superannuation laws. Now, members of parliament get highly criticised for their lucrative pension schemes because, you know, in New South Wales, for example, after 7 years, you get a pension for life, or you did get a pension for life from the moment you retired. And we had some wonderful scandals, well, not scandals, but, you know, 33-year-olds retiring on an index pension for life. Not bad. I wish I could have done it. You know, I was just on the wrong scheme. But they changed that in 1999 so that from something like the 1st of December 1999, any member elected now can only get their pension from the age of 55. So that, in some respects, made it harder for the parties to attract people, is what I'm being told. Now, I couldn't sort of say if that's true, because it still seems like a pretty good job. But then they put to me things like, you give up your career, you go in for, in some parliaments, obviously only 3 years, 4 years. You have to go up, as Maurice Payne said, you've got to go up for pre-selection. There's been some terrible bloodletting going on in New South Wales. You might have noticed a few changes lately. Your career may not be very long. And I think that must have some sort of sobering effect on whether you want to put yourself through the kind of public humiliation, your family gets dragged in. Things have changed, you know. We're willing to go. You know, the media will follow you in through your front door now. And there's no real perks coming at the end of it. You've got to wait like the rest of us for our retirement scheme. I don't know, is that having an impact on... So now you're only getting those people who want a career and that this is what they do.
Partisan warriors.
Sorry?
Partisan warriors.
Yeah. They're the people that they're getting who'll come and now do this, and it's changing the way the House operates. So, I don't know.
I noticed earlier John Summers had his hand up. Do you want to ask your question quickly, John?
John Summers, Flinders University. I don't really understand the objection to treasurers coming from an upper house. I think probably it's quite possible that South Australia did it before anyone else. And on the impression...
Generally first in everything, aren't they, South Australians?
I'm sure it was a Liberal government and was just the one of the more competent people wanted to be treasurer. He was in the upper house. He was a professional politician. He'd never done anything except work for a minister and be a politician. But it gave prominence to the upper house, and I think the upper house was actually held in higher esteem. It got more publicity in the questions that it asked, and it gave greater prominence to it. I don't see the objection. But just on the other question about the voting systems, it seems to me that it depends a bit what you want. Do you want a deliberative body that's made up of wise people who are all deliberating on something and coming to some good legislative outcome, or is the principal objective of your voting system is to come up with something that will give you those constitutional safeguards? And if the latter is the case, I think why not just have the Senate system?
We've got it.
Where people vote can go in on party lines. We had that 20-year period when people didn't even have to think about it. They knew what they had to do. They just would go in and vote for their preferred party for the lower house, and they would vote for the Democrats in the upper house or in the Senate, and that kind of imploded. And there were, and there's a period when people don't know what to do when they go in for the moment. But I think they'll work it out, and what they'll be voting for is not for the Greens or whatever. They'll be voting for that constitutional guarantee, that constitutional safeguard.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's largely a statement, so we probably don't need to respond. But I think you and I
would agree that with Harry earlier on that the most valuable thing is to have some sort of constitutional check. Okay, we might argue about how it can be made better, but that's the fundamental value of an upper house. Okay, we've gone well into coffee time, so I think we'll call a halt at this point. Thank you. There's a lot of interesting detail.
Yeah, so that it's a kind of interesting practical.
Okay, let's get underway. This is the last session. This is the one for the true believers, the one who are here, been here since 8:30 or 8:45 and determined to stay through till 5 o'clock. I know why I'm here. I'm curious as to why you're here. There are at least two good reasons for you to be here, Richard and Stephen. Two brief messages. There's a computer now available here. It's a computer at large. If you're a unicameralist, you can use it. If you're a bicameralist, you can use both hands. Either way, free for use, presumably ideally used between sessions rather than while a session is on, although who knows, stranger things have happened in this building. Also, we've taken the return to order seriously, and there are now more papers at the back of the room that have come in, including Brian Costa's paper, which I didn't actually get your permission to get copies made, but knowing what a generous fellow you are, I took advantage of that. This is the final session, and we'll start to move beyond Australia. We started with Canberra. We've then moved to the States. We're now going to go to the region, and the region is really the Asia-Pacific region, and we're going to start with that most wonderful Pacific island, Tasmania. And we're starting with Richard Herr. Richard and I have been involved in more skirmishes in the study of Parliament than I can remember. Richard's been at the University of Tasmania, he tells me, for 36 years. That's almost impossible, looking at his charming exterior, to think that there are 36 years beating inside of that. He was educated, PhD in political science at Duke University, so brings an external appraisal to Australian parliamentary performance. He's an expert on the region, not just Tasmania, but the Pacific Islands, particularly Fiji, but also has an adjunct appointment in Norway, which I don't think is in the Pacific, but a long way north of the equator. He's the co-founder of the Australasian Study of Parliament Group, which many of you would have been involved in various times. He's also been awarded OAM, the Medal in the Order of Australia, for his scholarly contribution to parliamentary studies in Australia in Australasia. And Stephen Sherlock was locked up in this building for over a decade, working as a parliamentary researcher in the Parliamentary Library. And the Parliamentary Library, alas, missed the opportunity to give him another decade of servitude, and he escaped and has become now an independent consultant. I see him from time to time at the ANU, but it's the ANU's loss that he's not there on a more regular basis. He's based in Jakarta as a political consultant. He's an expert on the Indonesian Parliament, but an advisor generally to aid agencies and development agencies on what to do with legislative institutions. He works with an organisation based at the Australian National University, the Centre for Democratic Institutions, CDI, and has lots of work experience with bodies like the World Bank, UNDP, and, of course, AusAid. Richard, start with you.
Thank you very much, John, and it's certainly nice to be back, although the weather in Canberra isn't a whole lot warmer than it is in Hobart, so... just a quick bit of news, because there's not a lot that links the South Pacific to Australia in parliamentary terms. One or two things, but one thing that does occurred only a few hours ago, and that's when the court in Fiji upheld the right, the power of the president to run the country after the December 06 coup. So the and that was related. I was in Fiji at the time during the court case, and much of the government's defence was on the reserve powers of the president, drawn from its period under the monarchy and the Australian precedents, particularly 75 and others, were drawn into that debate, and obviously that had some effect. There are others who worry about the independence of the court and may think that there were other factors involved, but I wouldn't. Anyway, let me... when John put me the task, I said, well, I wanted to talk about some of the problems of the small parliament in Tasmania. And he said that was fine. I could segue it into the question of small parliaments in the Pacific. So that's, I'm using size, and does it matter? Obviously, in some senses, for those of you students of federalism, we know that large countries tend to be federations, and federations tend to have houses, upper houses, that are based on the federal compact, and so, yeah, size matters there. Size, interestingly enough, can be a factor in the number of seats as well, so that, for example, in Australia, the Senate is, as near as practical, half the size of the lower house. India, it's the upper house is one-third the size of the lower house. Italy, I'm told, is half the size of the lower house. I believe Ricardo firmly on this. It sounded very good over several glasses of wine last night. And what was interesting to me about India was that it also sets a lower limit on the size of the upper house by specifying it should be 40, no less than 40. And that means that the lower house has to be at least 120 in size before you can have an upper house. As I said, federalism is a factor in bicameralism. The IPU said in one of its publications in 61, it happened to be, as I was moving out of my office, I looked at all books to decide whether I would keep them or not. And it said, it caught my eye, that federal states are invariably bicameral. Well, size is even a factor here, because only one of the three federal members, federal state members of the Pacific Islands Forum, that's Australia, has a states-based upper house. So obviously that's changed since 1961, at large as a consequence of size. Just turning quickly to Tasmania, Tasmania's upper house, the Legislative Council, has become increasingly controversial due in large measure to the reduction in the size of the parliament in 1998. The major parties attempted to eliminate the Greens, and it was interesting to me that they found it easier to change the parliament than the Electoral Act. If you want, for those of you who think that conventions and Westminster models don't really matter, its politicians did this because they figured that it was a lot easier to change a parliament than it was to change an Electoral Act. And I find that appalling. But they did it in a way which was meant to be self-serving. And if it had been done in, for example, Fiji, we would regard it as an undemocratic act by elites to eliminate opposition, but not a whimper in Tasmania. So the House went down from 35 to 25, and the Legislative Council went down from 19 to 15. What this did, sorry, the PC didn't like the conversion from my Mac, so it's this is an older one that I used for a business meeting to explain to them the consequences of the change. Basically, here, this is another impact that Australia had. When we helped to draft the constitution for Papua New Guinea, one of the provisions that appears there is that the government, the ministry, can be no larger than one quarter the size of the parliament. And the reason for that was a recognition in a party-based parliament that the only effective control on the front bench is the back bench. And so it tried to manufacture a circumstance where the back bench would be larger than the front bench. Of course, government set out to get around that by creating other little offices and so forth that make people beholden to them and so forth. But at least that's it's a kind of useful notion about accountability in the lower house. Well, in the case of Tasmania, as you can see, if you had a minimum majority government, which is 13, the nine ministers would make it 69%. When we've had buses running regularly in front of Parliament House over the last couple of years, lost two deputy premiers in quick succession, and therefore recently it was necessary for the Tasmanian government to appoint new ministers from the upper house. And that has created a series of problems for the Legislative Council. The Council itself, after 1998, became certainly a far more effective resistor to the government. And we saw this recently, and for example, when the Lennon government tried to cancel the GBE hearings, the Government Business Enterprise hearings, the Legislative Council said, fine, cancel yours, but we'll go ahead and hold ours. And the government decided it was impractical or indeed undesirable that only the Legislative Council should hold the GBE hearing, so they acceded to that. And then when a couple of Labour mates got together and created a monopoly called the Tasmanian Compliance Corporation, it was the Upper House Committee that exposed the rot and brought an end to several careers. But the appointment of the ministers in the Legislative Council produced, oddly enough, a claim from the government of greater accountability by the government. And that was really an attempt to try and break down the divisions between the two houses in order to move toward a unicameral as a way out of the possibly small-sized parliament that we have. They all recognise that it's too small. Indeed, they recognised that in 1998, privately, almost every member of the parliament admitted to me that they knew it was the wrong thing to do. But, gee, it felt good to try and get rid of the Greens, and what the hell, let's do it anyway. The trouble is that the legislative councillors really aren't comfortable with his executive oversight role. They haven't taken well so far to question time, although it's only been a few days of sitting that they've actually had the new role with three ministers there. So we'll see. But it's certainly the small size has put a lot of pressure on the Legislative Council. It's a great deal of difficulty in holding, staffing committees and holding committee meetings. The government has tried to get around this by creating or arguing for more joint committees so they can get government members onto them and try and get some control of the Legislative Council committees. And we've even had the situation where a minister chaired a joint committee meeting into his own portfolio. Okay. And tell me it doesn't matter, but I think it does. Anyway, that's the small parliament and change in a small parliament. This is the next area I want to deal with. This is what most people think of the South Pacific looks like. A lot of blue, a few names that they've heard of, Fiji, Samoa, Tahiti, etc., and not much else. This is the South Pacific that I know. It doesn't show up terribly well, but tens of thousands of islands scattered over an area three times the size of Australia, with only about 7 million people, 22 different polities in it, 14 of which are independent. Most of these 14 members, and that's the coloured sheet, you can start looking at that, that's why I gave it to you to prevent you from looking at me, most of these 14 members states are so small that if you were designing the parliaments for them, you'd have a hard time creating a second chamber. Moreover, because parties were less well established at the time and still are relatively weak in this region, organizing the parliamentary agenda through parties is less of a factor, so there's less perceived need for a House of Review. Indeed, quite the reverse. Often it's seen that government stability that is more the problem, that governments fall too readily, and government stability is more of the issue than getting the review of government activity. Nonetheless, with regard to second chambers, there isn't any real general rule here. For example, Papua New Guinea, with over 5 million people, is a unicameral, and Palau is the smallest of the countries with that it's bicameral, and that's about 20,000 people. The real question is, why are there second and, as I'll say in a minute, third houses in the Pacific Islands region? National coherence and integration seems to be the major factor here for the existence of multiple chambers. Traditional leadership was important, and one of the ways of co-opting this into the new countries was to give them a house of their own. More than half of the FIC stands for Forum Island Countries. That's to distinguish the 14 island members of the Pacific Islands Forum from Australia and New Zealand. More than half of the FICs include chiefly influence in some formal way at the national level. Not only is size not related to then the existence of second chambers, neither is federalism. That's that chart. You can look through it. I'll explain it as I go through. If we look at the existence of second and third chambers in the Pacific Islands, three states have formal upper houses: Fiji, the Marshall Islands, and Palau. The Marshall Islands and Palau aren't terribly surprising in some senses because they were American colonies and were to some extent influenced in the way they structured their political process along American lines. Fiji didn't have an upper house at independence, only came along in 72, and it was there for other reasons, in effect, a power-sharing kind of structure, and I'll come to that in a little while. Of these three, however, only two have power, that's to say Fiji and Palau. The Marshall Islands Second Chamber, the House of Arroy, is advisory only. Four states have informal second or third chambers, however. That's to say, four of the states, as you can see from that chart, which I don't have in front of me now. That's one of the weaknesses of doing it the way I did it. Sorry. The Cook Islands, the Fiji, Palau, and Vanuatu, thanks, John, do have, in effect, chambers which are informal in the sense that they weren't necessarily constitutionally mandated, although in the case of Fiji this has become so, or they have only an advisory role to integrate the traditional power structure into the post-independent state. However, in the case of Fiji, the third chamber may well be more powerful than the Senate. The Great Council of Chiefs has an enormous amount of power and indeed is a critical element of modern Fiji politics, as we'll see again in a moment. In addition, two unicameral parliaments have structures that have some of the features of a second house. Papua New Guinea, these are the ones that are yellow on your chart there. Papua New Guinea has its 19 provincial governors and the governor of the National Capital Territory, so that's 20, in the unicameral, but they're there in a quasi-representational role for their provinces. Nauru is even funnier in some ways because it has two parallel political systems, the National Parliament and something that used to be called the Local Government Council. It's now called the Nauru Island Council. And they have exactly the same constituency, cover the same area, but the Local Government Council used to be so powerful that it could actually bring down the national government, as Hammer de Robert, the first president, showed when they decided not to re-elect him as president. And he went on to be went back to being head chief of the local government council and used it as a vehicle to bring down the national government and resume his rightful place as president. Just to go through the functions of these of the four upper houses, formal upper houses that we have, I included Tasmania for vanity as well as the fact that I included in your chart. Some of the interesting features of it. Fiji, for example, the Senate cannot initiate legislation, but it has the power to amend it and to review or delay it. It has some powers of executive oversight, or we think it will do. It's, of course, suspended since 06, December 06. And it has a role in providing ministers. In the case of the marshals, the House of Arroyos, as I said, is essentially advisory, although because it can request some bills, I said it may have some power to delay legislation by simple fact of requesting to review the legislation before it's passed by the lower house or by the national parliament. Palau basically is almost as powerful as the Senate. But the interesting feature of it is that, where I've said protecting the federal balance, as I know with emphasis, it's because it's the lower house that represents the states. The 16 states of Palau are have one member each to the lower house. That's the whole of the lower house. And they have 9 members from geographically defined constituencies. So it's a federal system, but the lower house represents the federal compact, as it were. And because it has a separation of powers, of course, no member of the cabinet can be a member of the Congress. The interesting feature, and I have to direct you back to your color chart for this, is the SFM, the Federated States of Micronesia, is a definite federal state with 6 quite autonomous member states, but it has no second chamber to represent the federal compact at all, and I'm not quite sure how the FSM actually works out these, other than perhaps through their unicameral. What I found particularly interesting was, until John forced me to look at it, the role of these Council of Chiefs in it. As I said, the traditional political order is recognized in a separate house in nearly a third of the fix, Fiji, the Marshals, Palau, and Vanuatu. And as I said, it's not the full extent because, for example, the Solomons have Council of Chief at a provincial level. Samoa, after the change in the after a referendum, I think it was 1991, has universal suffrage. Before that, suffrage was limited to chiefs. Now, suffrage is universal, but only chiefs can be elected. And in Tonga, the nobility, I think it's 34 titles held by 32 individuals, because 2 have joint titles. Is that right? Lopi's gone. They elect a third of the parliament. So it's a very Whig kind of parliament, at least before it's been reformed, the Tongan parliament was. The commoners get to elect a third of the parliament. The nobility gets to elect a third of the parliament. And the king gets to appoint a third of the parliament. You know, what could be fairer than that? In the Cooks, the House of Ariki is described in their literature as a parliamentary chamber, but it's purely advisory, and the parliament itself is officially listed as unicameral.